response times lag for his constituents. And so I contacted him to say, hey, this is pretty weird. You know, there's a file on me, but it came back all blacked out. And Greg is married to Marwa Risky, who's also an MNA, a member of the National Assembly, who's very popular, a very well-known education critic and extremely articulate. And Marwa called me back and said, hey, I'm going to file an accident info for your file. Well, I said, okay. And apparently she did with Greg, and they notified me just recently that it's been moving forward slowly, but that they couldn't get the information. They were told that it would compromise cabinet security to release the file.
Is that all they were told? Like, were they given a reason? How would it compromise cabinet security? Did they get any explanation?
Well, I don't know. Perhaps they did, but they appealed that decision. And that was a note from Greg saying that they appealed and access to information has now requested mediation with them. And as Greg said, you know, the wheels of justice turn slowly, but apparently they've made good progress. So I look forward to finding out, because in order to compromise cabinet security, that would imply that it was a cabinet level decision to keep a file on me in the last ambulance,
yeah.
Which is really incredible when you think that that was in the early days of the last ambulance.
Well, when you find out, we're going to have to get back together and you're going to have to tell us what's in there. Hal, thank you so much for talking to me today.
Thank you. I mean, it's really a privilege for me to share the story. Thank you.
That's your Candleland. You can email Jesse at jesse@candleland.com. He reads them all. And I'm Karen at candleland.com with a Y because my parents spelled it that way. Our website is at candleland.com. Our senior producer is Bruce Thorson. Audio production and editing from Tristan Capacchione. I am Karen Pugliese, the editor-in-chief. Max Collins is our production manager. Theme music is by So-Called. Syndication is handled by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca.
Hi there. You just heard Canada Land, the show where I'm typically joined by a different guest each week for a long feature interview. What you're going to hear next is Canada Land Shortcuts, a topical news show where I'm joined by a different co-host each week, and we talk about the media's coverage of various stories in the news right now. Wait for it.
Welcome to Hell. My name is Justin Ling, and I am your guest host this week as Jesse Brown was carried off by a pack of wild beavers. My guest this week is the shockingly popular YouTuber, political columnist, and noted sayer of a boot, JJ McCullough. Hi there, JJ.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. On this week's show, the presidential testing of our patience, from cheap fakes to Biden's debate headache to the deep state plot to cover up the president's melting brain. We've sure fit a lot of media narratives into just a few crazy weeks. Welcome to Shortcuts, where we talk about the news.
If we finally beat Medicare.
He says he's fine, physically and cognitively. But is he really?
I know you said you have an ongoing assessment. Have you had a full neurological and cognitive evaluation?
I get a full neurological test every day.
Well, I took two tests, cognitive tests. I aced it.
Medical doctors, some of the best in the world, travel me everywhere I go.
First questions are very easy. The last questions are much more difficult.
I have an ongoing assessment of what I'm doing.
Like you'll go person, woman, man, camera, TV.
With dealing with everything we have to do with.
So it's person, woman, man, camera, TV.
I've been testing everywhere I go. Okay.
Give us that again. Can you do that again? And you go person, woman, man, camera, TV. If you get it in order, you get extra points. They said nobody gets it in order. It's actually not that easy, but for me it was easy.
JJ, before we delve into the whole presidential fracas of the past few weeks, I know you've been talking about this. You made a video about it. I just have four questions for you. I think it's important we do a cognitive assessment test before we start any of this conversation. So just four easy questions.
All right.
Just see what the results say.
Okay.
All right. Number one, what is the day?
It's Wednesday.
Okay. Well, what is the date?
The date? July 10th.
All right. Spell the word world backwards.
D-L-O... No, wait. I screwed this up already. Oh, I can't be president, Justin.
All right. And the last question is, what year is it?
It is 2024. That much I know. I'm bad at spelling. I'm a little dyslexic. I you caught me on that one. I'm unfit to be commander-in-chief. Yeah, I'm sorry.
I found this test online, obviously, and I've calculated the results, and it says, and this is a technical diagnosis, it says you have pudding brain. So I'm sorry. I'm sorry to break this news to you. Listen, JJ, I'm not sure if you've noticed, but a lot of American and even Canadian journalists have suddenly, and very recently, deputized themselves as cognitive specialists over the last couple of months. If you pick up a copy of the Washington Post, you may hear them interviewing cognitive specialists saying that Joe Biden's recent campaign missteps might show that he's addled, infirm, or out of his depth. You've seen a ton of TV news bring on cognitive specialists, Parkinson's specialists, aging specialists to tell us how all of his memory issues are signs of something deeper. Before we even get into any of the specifics, what do you make of some of this coverage over the last couple of weeks?
Well, it's quite striking because not only has everybody become sort of an overnight expert in cognitive ability of people that they're just observing through the television, people have also seemingly discovered a new clause in the Constitution that says that in order to be fit to serve as president of the United States, you have to meet a certain standard of communication effectiveness. The thing that just really gets to me is I've always been a huge critic of debates in general. I think that they're very phony and performative and do not reflect anything about sort of the competence for office of a politician. And I think that this major crazy freakout over Biden's presidential sort of debate performance is just another illustration of that, is that we have given way, 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 way too much importance to these debates. And I think, frankly, we've given way, 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 way too much importance to the politician's communication effectiveness as somehow a proxy for their fitness for the job overall. The whole case against Biden from a sort of cognitive perspective is all based on communication skills. And to me, I don't know, that says something about the degree that presidents are now functioning primarily as media figures more than anything else.
Yeah, I think I disagree to a wild degree on, I think, everything you just said. But let's rewind the clock a little bit before as we build up to that. Because you know, what's so striking to me is that, okay, yes, we have deputized ourselves neurological experts with very little competency in that regard. But what's so interesting to me is that up until that debate, which, you know, now it feels like an eternity, but it's been, you know, 2 weeks now, up until that debate, the media narrative was that a lot of the allegations around Biden's decline were actually misinformation. You know, we even coined a new term to describe all of the videos that had been published over, you know, mostly from the Trump campaign, sometimes from the New York Post, sometimes on Fox News, whatever. We started calling them cheap fakes. And, you know, these are videos that were deceptively edited. You know, there's that video, I'm sure everyone's seen it by now, that video of Biden at the D-Day memorial kind of wandering off as every other world leader is watching this paratrooper come down from the sky. And the video shows Biden sort of meandering off into a field. And then, you know, if you zoom out, you actually realize that he's going to talk to a different paratrooper, right? You know, there's a video out there of him supposedly trying to sit down on a chair that doesn't exist. It turns out there actually was a chair. Again, it was this weird camera angle. And so you had this whole media narrative that went on for a number of weeks that basically said, you know, Biden may be aging, but, you know, the idea that he's facing serious cognitive decline, it's all misinformation. Don't worry about it. It's just an RNC plot to dupe you into thinking that there's something amiss when things are mostly fine. And in fact, a lot of the coverage, I mean, over the last couple of years has also highlighted Trump's supposed slide into dementia, hence why he was pushed into doing this cognitive test, which He 100% aced during his presidency. And it's been interesting to watch that narrative completely pivot just within like an hour of the debate happening away from, don't worry, this is all a disinformation campaign, to, okay, yeah, maybe the president does in fact have pudding brain.
I mean, my perspective is that two things in theory do not have to sort of contradict each other, right? Like, it can be very much the case that the videos were selectively edited, as you sort of said, and were not in fact an accurate reflection of Biden's cognitive state. But again, to go back to what I was saying before, that Biden's communication skills could still be much worse than people had previously realized. And so I think that if maybe there's a sort of sense of betrayal on the part of the press, it has to do with the communication side of things more than just sort of his cognitive fitness. Because I think that the other argument, an argument that the press has been making pretty consistently, is that Biden doesn't do enough interviews, Biden doesn't do enough press conferences, you know, the communication side of the job, Biden has been sort of weirdly hesitant. You know this as much as anybody else, you know, a politician who has a lot of time for the press, who spends a lot of time with reporters, generally gets better publicity than one that doesn't. And so I think in that sense, if the press feels betrayed, the press feels like that they have been denied access in part because the White House is covering up the deficiency of the politician, then I think that it makes sense that they would be quite so red hot. Because it does seem like when we look at sort of this whole narrative about, you know, Biden should step down and there are increasing calls for Biden to step down and Biden's embattled presidency, it does seem like much, much more of a media-driven narrative than anything that seems to be sort of sincerely driven by the grassroots.
It's actually fascinating how much media narratives still become dominant and how much, because I think you're right, I think the media is helping drive this discussion in a major way. If you told me a decade ago that the media would still have this power and still have this inclination to set the narrative kind of writ large and create this huge sort of all-encompassing meta narrative, I would have told you you're insane. There's no way we're still going to have enough sort of establishment media or still have enough kind of media dominance to do that. But that's where we're at, right? Like the media, if anything, more than before, more than even, you know, the early 2000s, is capable and willing and interested in creating these kind of default established narratives. And it's funny because I think especially the U.S. press and the Canadian press is always sort of just nipping at their heels in this respect. The American press seems to think it's become more enlightened, right? Like it went through this whole thing with Hillary Clinton. Looking back, we now know that it was a mix of the Internet Research Agency out of Russia, but also a bunch of Trump supporters, but also just a bunch of random people online who were pushing the idea that Hillary Clinton had Parkinson's when in fact she had like, you know, a mild case of pneumonia. But people were diagnosing her by videos of her kind of leaving campaign events and looking kind of woozy on stage. And the media fed into it, like actively, rabidly, enthusiastically fed into the idea that Hillary Clinton was sick and ailing. And I think you can make the case that it actually helped cost her the presidency, that and like 10 other things. But like, it really did hurt her.
One sort of perspective that I've heard on all of this, which I think is quite interesting, is the degree to which the establishment press, the elite press, the prestige press, whatever we could call it, does seem like it is mostly just kind of having an internal conversation with its increasingly sort of progressive liberal readership at the expense of sort of the rest of America. A sort of common refrain that I've heard from some sort of more progressive defenders of Biden has been like, where are the editorials calling for Trump to drop out? Where are, you know, the editorials declaring Trump unfit for office and expressing the sort of high dungeon sort of outrage at sort of Trump, the way that there has been, you know, so much ink spilled about Biden's unfitness? And the only way that that really makes sense is that sort of publications like the New York Times or Vox or The Atlantic or The New Yorker or whatever just care much more about their progressive audience, their progressive readership, and view their role as journalists much more. They just kind of take it for granted that obviously no conservatives read them.
But also, you know, going back to your point about, you know, this feeling of betrayal, like you actually do hear it from some journalists and from some pundits, like they genuinely are angry that they've been lied to effectively by the White House and the Democratic campaign. And they are kind of lashing out. And like, you know, we're going to come back in a second to whether or not Biden is competent to run, because, you know, clearly you disagree, but I think he's not. But I'm fascinated by this one story that ran in the Times just a couple days ago. The headline is Parkinson's expert visited the White House 8 times in 8 months. And when you first see this story, it's like, you know, gobsmacking, you're like, oh my God, like this is the smoking gun, right? Like they like, and it feeds into this idea that the White House is keeping something from us, right? Like that Biden has had Parkinson's for the better part of a year and they weren't telling anybody, God, they're a danger to the country. This is horrifying. It's not until you actually dig into the story that you find out that this Parkinson's expert has been visiting the White House since 2012, and that he's actually been part of the medical unit, not just providing expertise on the president's health, but on general matters of policy. And it's also been treating, I think, veterans through like the White House Veteran Healthcare Unit. And the Times knows all of this and puts it in the story and just rams it through anyway. And I find that absolutely gobsmacking. And probably pretty good evidence for the idea that there is a sort of, to some degree, a wounded sort of emotional response coming from the White House press corps on this.
Well, and I think there's also just a kind of cheap sensationalism, right? Like a cheap desire for clicks. Like it's a compelling narrative. Like it's the most dramatic story of this election cycle. The idea that the president might drop out or might even resign, as you've sort of seen.
Agreed. But also, I look at all this reporting now, all of these sources saying, or in and around the White House, in and around from around the president, saying, oh yeah, we've known this for ages. Like he's been declining, obviously, for some time. Like he's sharp as hell one day. You know, he's lecturing Benjamin Netanyahu from the Situation Room one day, but the next day, you know, he's clearly kind of forgetting people's names and, you know, kind of wandering around aimlessly and doesn't seem as sharp as he used to and all this. Journalists might feel duped by the White House. I feel duped by our journalists in the press corps, right? Like, far from feeling like this is just a totally, you know, media-driven narrative, like I think you do to some degree, I think it's the opposite. I think us downplaying his age concerns was the media-driven narrative, and now the floodgates are open. Any reasonable person watching that debate would come away with the feeling that Joe Biden is no longer fit to be president, not just because he's not capable of communicating, but because he's not capable of formulating thoughts from his brain in a critical moment. Like that is a skill that goes far beyond just campaigning or political communication. That is a skill that affects his ability to negotiate with Congress, to negotiate with world leaders, and ultimately to win the campaign. There's a poll out today, a couple internal polls reported out by Politico, that suggests that New York State is suddenly, you know, maybe not a toss-up, but, you know, it's been downgraded from, you know, solid Democrat to maybe leaning Democratic. That is terrifying. Like, holy, we are on track to watch Joe Biden lose this campaign in a spectacular fashion. And given that Joe Biden's entire appeal is he's the guy who can win the campaign, how is he still the nominee? But tell me about the Canadian context, because, you know, I think, you know, people have drawn the comparison, as I think you have on your YouTube channel, between the effort to take down Biden from inside and, you know, save the Republic, and the sort of failed campaign to oust the prime minister that has seemingly fizzled with kind of like equal limpness. Are there similarities between the effort to remove the president and the effort to remove the prime minister?
I mean, I think there are obvious similarities in the sense that in both cases, it seems like it's a strategic decision more than anything else. I mean, despite that, you know, there is at least a case to be made that Biden is not able to do the job in a sort of functional way. Obviously, the much bigger argument is that, you know, yeah, like you just sort of said, that Biden could lose the election. And that's obviously the main case against Trudeau. Nobody's making an argument that Trudeau is sort of cognitively impaired necessarily, although I suppose some people would make that argument from the get-go. But the argument is primarily that this is a matter of political strategy, and that if Trudeau cannot lead his party to success in a Toronto riding that had voted Liberal for three decades, you know, then clearly the game is over. I think in both America and Canada, there is often sort of a point of no return. You've been in office for too long. The party has been in power for too long. It's the same thing that happened in Great Britain. You know, they keep swapping out leaders and hoping that that'll help them sort of change the channel. And it doesn't, because people are just sick of you. There's times in which there's like fundamentally, you know, this is an old media cliche, right? Some elections are just change elections, and there's a limited ability to sort of resist that. And, you know, I think we've seen that many times actually in Canadian history, in contrast to the US, where they don't tend to swap leaders mid-election. We've seen that many times in Canada that they have, you know, whether that's John Turner or Kim Campbell, or, you know, countless times at the provincial level. And by and large, it seems to always fail. So, you know, maybe with the exception of Paul Martin, I would also say, you know, I'm not the biggest fan of Trudeau, but I do think that there is a case to be made that Trudeau is a man who is sort of chronically underestimated. I remember in our Sun News days, Justin, I would often be taking some pretty condescending pot shots at Justin's abilities, and he sort of proved me wrong.
You, me, and Faith Goldie, I think. Good old days.
Yes, of course. No, but, you know, he proved us all wrong, right? Like, Justin Trudeau has proven an ability to be a much better campaigner and to bounce back, to snatch victory from the jaws of failure. I mean, it still boggles my mind that he bounced back from the blackface thing, which dropped in the middle of a campaign. So, you know, I think that obviously he still has a huge, huge uphill battle to fight, but it doesn't seem irrational to me to assume that this man who has routinely sort of exceeded expectations might be able to pull off, you know, another miracle.
JJ, I understand you have brought a duly noted in, and it's about the Online Harms Act.
So the Online Harms Act is obviously a manifestation of the Liberal government's quite ambitious desires to regulate the internet. It's similar to Bill C-11 in that way, which is another bill, you know, the Online Streaming Act, which I've been squawking a lot about over the years. But what I thought was interesting about the Online Harms Act was that the Conservatives had recently requested that the Parliamentary Budget Officer do a cost assessment of it. And they got back with the report. And not only is this sort of the implementation of the Online Harms Act sort of expected to cost about $200 million over the course of 5 years to implement, it's also going to entail hiring over 300 bureaucrats and will take at least 2 years to fully implement, because these 300 bureaucrats are going to be staffed in sort of three different government departments. And yeah, it's going to take 2 years to sort of fully implement, is the Parliamentary Budget Officer's estimation. And this is relevant because, obviously, we're having an election in less than 2 years. And the Conservative Party, which is on track to win that election, has said that they're going to tear up the Online Harms Act. And this reminds me of Bill C-11, because the CRTC recently put out a timeline that estimated that the full implementation of Bill C-11 is not scheduled to take place until after next year's election as well. It says something to me about the degree to which the Liberal government is in many ways sort of smothering their own legislative initiatives under the crippling weight of a bureaucracy that they seem to be incapable of stopping the expansion of. It's a very sort of interesting, very validating, I suppose, state of affairs for people on the right end of the political spectrum. The idea that bureaucracy is killing their own sort of half-baked ideas.
I still can't get over this. Like, I am violently in favor of regulating, at least to some degree, social media. Like, I would rather see us remove their liability protections, but whatever. You know, some stuff in this bill is good enough, I guess. But it also goes so far in some of, like, you know, opening this up to the Human Rights Tribunal just strikes me as one of the stupidest imaginable things you could do in this bill. And it's going to make it such a target, such an easy target to repeal if or when the Conservatives get in. And frankly, good riddance. I hope they do get rid of it, because it's just a bad idea. And I can tell you by talking to some people who helped draft the bill, they're not happy with what it ended up being. Anyway, duly noted. So JJ, my duly noted for this week is something that's become a bit of a running topic between me and Jesse on this show. To give you the really, really, really quick background, in June, Google announced that the Canadian Journalism Collective, this group dominated by this company called IndieGraph, would be responsible for doling out $100 million in fees associated with the Online News Act. Now, I raised a bunch of concerns. I think there's some conflicts of interest here. I'm concerned about the capacity of this organization to actually get the money out the door. I'm concerned that one group seems to be overrepresented on it. I'm concerned that they didn't go with the big companies that actually do the majority of the local journalism in this country. But anyway, Jesse was not super impressed. He issued a clarification about my segment. He suggested I was over my skis and that I am somebody who knows almost nothing about the news publishing business.
Justin Ling is a super news reporter, and like most news reporters, he knows almost nothing about the news publishing business.
Jesse went on to say that this Canadian Journalism Collective has no real power over anything. They don't decide who qualifies. They don't decide who gets the money or how it's divvied up or doled out. They are mere flesh vessels for this cold, hard search engine hush money. Okay, well, fine. This is a disagreement between me and Jesse. That's totally fine. Although I will point out that other organizations have basically backed me up since that show. News Media Canada, alongside a bunch of local journalism organizations, have echoed those concerns about the possible conflicts. They've issued 10 recommendations on how the collective could overcome those, including adding more diversity to their board. We've heard concerns from columnists in the National Post. There was a mini scandal driven by, I should say, bad faith organization Honest Reporting Canada, which is just exists to harass people in the media. But regardless, they dredged up a bunch of tweets from one board member of the collective, and she was forced to apologize, further sort of distracting from the issue at hand. Okay, all of that kind of put behind us. I want to add a little bit more fuel to the fire, because over the last little while, we've started getting some of the documentation. I say some of the documentation because the collective has written to the CRTC to say it does not yet have ready policies regarding eligibility for the program, how they're going to verify full-time employee, that definition, how they're going to select membership, how they're going to disperse the funding, how they're going to resolve disputes. They have no documentation for those things yet and are asking for extensions until later this week to get it all done. Okay. But we have some of the documentation about the actual agreement between the collective and Google. And there's this little section in there that I think is really interesting because it says that both the collective and all of the members, those who are getting the money, are agreeing to forgo any bargaining process, complaint before the CRTC, or lawsuit regarding the, quote, infringement of copyright in relation to making available news content of members. Did the Canadian Journalism Collective just sign away their members' ability to sue Google for copyright infringement, particularly at a time when Google is hoovering up news content to feed its LLMs? I think it's a good question. I would love an answer to it.
Do we have any sort of sense of the timeline on this? Because I'm wondering if this is another thing that is just a lot of time wasting that will ultimately be undone by the Conservative administration.
I said this last time. I have a strong suspicion that no one is ever going to see a dollar of this money.
Duly noted.
That is Shortcuts for this week. Thank you, JJ, for joining me. I hope you had some degree of fun.
It was a load of fun. Thanks for having me.
You can email me all about it at justinling@proton.me. I swear I'll read it. I just won't reply. You can also subscribe to my newsletter at bugeyedandshameless.com, or, I don't know, just Google bug-eyed and shameless. JJ, where can people find you?
They can find me on YouTube. If you just type in JJ Canada, I'll pop up. I know McCullough is hard to spell.
This episode was produced by James Nicholson, and additional production was done by Caleb Thompson. Our production manager is Max Collins. Our editor-in-chief is Karen Puglisi. Theme music is by So Cold. Syndication is by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. You can visit them online at cfuv.ca.
Democracy Now!, hosted by award-winning independent journalist Amy Goodman. Tune in to your daily progressive news, aired Monday through Friday at 11 a.m. on CJSF.
This is Bird Note. The sight of a heron standing in a marsh, stabbing at prey in the shallows, is familiar in many places. But a few heron species shun the daylight to hunt their prey by night. One of these nocturnal specialists, the black-crowned night heron, is found across much of the U.S. It also inhabits all the continents except Australia and Antarctica. It's even found in island groups as remote as Hawaii, making the black-crowned night heron the most widespread heron on Earth. Such a far-flung range suggests highly successful adaptation. Feeding at night, black-crowned night herons are freed from competing with the more numerous day-hunting herons. They're also very opportunistic feeders. While fish are often primary prey, the herons will consume everything from earthworms to clams to eggs of nesting birds and refuse at landfills. They also have a flexibly long breeding season, which may enable them to thrive across such a broad geographic range. Since they are high on the food chain, found over much of the world, and nest in colonies, black-crowned night herons can tell us a great deal about the health or contamination of our environment. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
You protect your keys? Simply attach a WarAmps key tag to your key ring. If you lose your keys, the WarAmps can return them to you by courier for free. WarAmps key tags, they're free and they work. Order yours at waramps.ca.